From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Leg Effect Weekend. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we hear from the Secretary for the Democratic National Committee about what to expect from the scaled-down convention. We learn about Black leaders organizing for communities and their efforts to engage voters.
So we try to really combine what are some of those really hyper-localized issues with kind of broader themes that we're hearing. And then are there openings and opportunities to advocate for some of the things that we want every year when it comes to the city budget?
Plus, Daniel Golden of Boswell Book Company joins us to share his annual summer reading recommendations with a Wisconsin theme.
I like to support our own, and I just think it's fun to have the local connections. And, you know, and books are just a great way of, as you said, vacationing without going away. And they're also a natural social distancing mechanism.
Lake Effect Weekend is next, but first this news. This is Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Over a year has passed since Milwaukee got the news it was picked to host the 2020 Democratic National Convention. And a lot has happened in that year, to say the least. The coronavirus pandemic has upended plans for any sort of routine in-person convention. In fact, there have been few details on exactly how it will unfold. We do know that presumptive nominee Vice President Joe Biden has plans to accept the nomination in the city, while delegates and members of Congress participate from their homes. But beyond Biden, we don't know exactly who or how many will be in Milwaukee. Milwaukee native Jason Ray is Secretary for the Democratic National Committee, President and CEO of the Wisconsin LGBT Chamber of Commerce, and part of a local political consulting firm. WUWM's Mayon Silver spoke to him about what to expect from this year's unusual convention. Ray starts by explaining what leadership roles in the DNC have meant to him.
Yeah, for me, you know, I first ran for the DNC in 2004 because I really wanted to make a statement at the time about young people being involved in our party. I was just 17, and on the DNC, there were about 447 individuals. And at that time, back in 2004, there were only about six who were under the age of 36. And I just wanted to talk about young people needing to have a voice in our party to be there. So I took a long shot run. I wasn't expecting to win in that race, but was really honored and humbled when the delegates at the state party convention voted for me. And I was elected to serve my first four-year term and was honored to be reelected three times by delegates from Wisconsin to serve as their representative on the DNC. And for me, it's been a real opportunity to help move our party forward. I really view my role within the party as helping to create change, helping to bring about the country that we want. I think it's really important to be involved politically to make sure that we are electing individuals that share my values and beliefs. And that is something that I'm really proud to have been a part of and was really honored to get to be elected as secretary.
What have you seen about Democratic outreach in Wisconsin over the past 4 years since 2016 when President Trump carried the state?
Yeah, I think what we've seen is a real investment from the party in organizing Wisconsin. We know that the road to the White House runs right through the Dairyland here. Our electoral votes are going to be so important in November, but it's not only about just the presidential race. You know, we are a swing state. It is races up and down the ballot. It is state house races. It is races for the U.S. House. There's a lot at stake here in Wisconsin. I think it's one of the reasons we've seen a real investment from the DNC here in Wisconsin. We have field organizers on the ground earlier than we've had before. And I talk with Tom Perez, when I talk with the chairman, he often reiterates, you know, how important Wisconsin is. And I know that we've seen that investment from the DNC since 2016.
So obviously the DNC chose Milwaukee to host its convention, and the world is a very, very different place than when it was originally chosen, you know, with the coronavirus pandemic. Can you walk me through what people can expect at the convention? What is it going to look like? What will the events be? Who will be there?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I think we are still trying to figure out all of those pieces at the moment. Front and center of all of our planning is the health and safety, not only of our convention participants, but most importantly, of the citizens of our host community, those people in Milwaukee. Whatever we end up producing for the convention is one that will have health and safety of our participants at top of mind. So we are still consulting with public health officials on a local, state, and national level to figure out what we'll be able to do for the convention. But, you know, those decisions will be made as we get closer to August.
The committee is telling people not to plan to travel from other states, and I'm wondering if there will be in-state travel so that delegates from Wisconsin will be able to come, or, for instance, Milwaukee delegates, would they be able to attend?
It's one of the things that is still being considered and looked at. No final decisions have been made on any of that yet. You know, we will make those decisions as we get closer with, you know, the health and safety of everyone, you know, front and center. That said, we did, you know, put in place, you know, procedures for delegates to be able to safely and securely perform their responsibilities as convention delegates remotely. We've shared notifications with the delegates who have been elected from the states on how that will take place the 2 weeks prior to convention to ensure that they are able to fulfill their responsibilities as a convention delegate.
Usually for delegates, the point is to pump up the crowd and bring the visuals. Like maybe we would have seen some cheese heads, you know, delegates from other places would do that stuff to, you know, bring local pride and excitement and also the networking. Now it doesn't seem like there will be much of that, or perhaps none of that. Why is it still important to be a delegate this year?
I think it's still vitally important. You know, we are working on ways as a convention to still engage delegates. We have launched a new delegate hub with which will allow members to our delegates to share their stories, to connect with one another, and really to talk about, you know, why they are a Democrat. And at the end of the day, this is still an important piece of party business, and our delegates will still be voting on our party's platform, on our party's nominee. So there's still vital party business that will take place during the convention, even though folks may not be physically here in Milwaukee. I know we are committed to finding ways to engage folks. I know state parties across the country are talking about ways that they can engage and excite delegates from their states as well with different programming and opportunities as we celebrate the convention.
Have you seen any interesting local mobilization in Wisconsin swing counties?
You know, I've seen a few folks start talking around, well, what might it look like? Are there virtual watch parties? Are there activities that may be taking place? I think it is one where folks, we are still about a month away from convention, so I think we'll start seeing more as we get closer to August 17th.
What do you think is gained and lost via both the virtual convention and virtual organizing?
You know, I think we are learning new tools and techniques to engage voters through this process. And I think that's one of the things that excites me most about the Democratic Party is we are being innovative in our approach and our outreach to ensure that we're still able to communicate our message and reach voters across the country. And I think folks do miss that human connection that you do get when you're face to face. But at the end of the day, we are always as a party going to put health and safety of the American people front and center, whether it's in our convention or in our electoral outreach as well.
One delegate told me that he actually really doesn't like the pomp and circumstance, and he's looking forward to a virtual convention because he says things will just be funneled into the essence of what people need to know instead of days and days of speeches. You know, that's kind of an interesting take.
You know, a lot of folks have different takes on it.
And so, you know, you've also said that the biggest thing out of all of this is just making sure that at the end of the day, we turn people out to vote and that we win this election. The only thing that matters right now is winning in November. So you've touched upon this a little bit, but how are Democrats planning on using the convention to help them win in November?
It's a great question. We're really using the convention here, at least for people in Wisconsin, as an organizing opportunity. I know the state party's working on different ways to engage folks, whether they're delegates or just folks who are interested in this, and really using this as an opportunity to propel us out of the convention into the general election this fall. This convention week will be an opportunity really to unite together as a party and to begin our work moving towards November.
What do you think the convention still means for the city of Milwaukee?
I think this is still going to be a convention that is anchored here in Milwaukee. This will still be an opportunity for us to show off our community, show off our leaders, show off who we are, as a people. And I'm excited for that. You know, this convention, while anchored here in Milwaukee, is still going to be our opportunity for the world to see who we are.
And what exactly does that mean, anchored? You know, like, I know you were kind of talking that you're talking to health professionals to try to see how things will be laid out, but are there any plans at this point to kind of know how it's going to be structured?
Yeah, we anticipate most of the business to be done. You know, official business will take place at the Wisconsin Center. The vice president has indicated that he intends to accept the nomination here in Milwaukee at the Wisconsin Center during the convention. So when we talk about that, we really think it is one that is anchored here, but there may be elements virtual or across the country as well that engage folks in their communities as a part of it.
You know, the Biden-Sanders Unity Task Forces were just meeting up and they issued their platform recommendations. Do you think that Democrats can get on the same page about what the party stands for in 2020?
I absolutely think that we are coming together, the party. We know that the stakes are too high not to come together and fight against Donald Trump. And I'm really excited for the unity that I have seen within our party since the primary process has concluded. And I can't wait for us to move forward together towards November to victory.
Do you expect protests?
I don't.
I mean, we're kind of in a new phase of life where there's, you know, there's racial justice protests breaking out all over the place. Do you anticipate anything like that?
You know, I think with convention, each convention is different than itself. And I think it's hard to predict right now what that week will look like here in Milwaukee until we get closer to having a better understanding of all the elements.
But, and is that something that you guys are preparing for, like in case there are protests?
You know, we as a convention are always preparing for all scenarios and everything that may happen. So it is definitely something that is, you know, a factor.
And on that, on the note of protests, I mean, the world is very different right now. The coronavirus pandemic, racial justice protests, the economy struggling. What are the main topics you want to hear from Joe Biden at the convention?
You know, I think we're going to hear from the vice president during the convention about his plan to move America forward, to return the soul of our country, how we're going to invest in America's working class, how we're going to help restore our integrity around the world. I'm excited to hear from the vice president about how we are going as a party to come together and really make sure that we are advocating for all people, for equal rights, for civil rights, and that we are really trying to make a difference, a positive difference in people's lives.
Do you see a possibility for another convention in Milwaukee, political or otherwise, going forward?
I absolutely do. I think, you know, we as a city have a real opportunity with this. And I think having, you know, even though it may not be the convention that many people had planned for, we really were able to showcase to the world, frankly, that Milwaukee has the capabilities to pull off and host a convention like this, that we have the amenities, that we have the space. I know that after the announcement came, Visit Milwaukee heard from several entities who now are interested in looking at Milwaukee for their convention. So I think we will see Milwaukee becoming a convention city, somewhere that people want to visit. I think with that, it's one where when people get to come here and they get to experience Milwaukee, they fall in love with this city. So I can't wait for other conventions, political or otherwise, to come to Milwaukee in the future.
One other question. So like right now, there's a lot of political division in the country, right? And things going virtual, do you think it helps it? Do you think it hurts it? Do you think people are getting more entrenched in their positions and in their bubbles online?
You know, I think we've always had kind of an echo chamber when it came to things online, where you follow the things that you agree with, you like the things you agree with on Facebook, you see those things, and you only hear from one side. That being said, I don't think it's entrenching. I think right now, if anything, people, I think, are more attuned to what's going on in the country and are paying attention and are looking and saying, who is, you know, what does leadership look like right now? How do we continue moving forward? That's kind of how I see it at the moment.
And change is a really important topic for especially Black voters and young Black voters, and especially now with, you know, the George Floyd protests that erupted. Do you think Biden is going to be able to mobilize the Black vote in Milwaukee?
I absolutely do. I think the vice president, one of the strengths of his candidacy is he is a coalition builder who really brings people together and gets people excited. I think we saw that, you know, during the primary in South Carolina, where he was really able to get a commanding percentage of the African-American vote. And I know that the folks that I've talked to in Milwaukee are excited about his candidacy, are can't wait to get behind him and get out there and organize within their communities. So I'm not concerned. I think the vice president really is in a position that will really, you know, while I take nothing for granted, I'm excited for what I'm hearing and seeing.
Even though there may be a generational gap between like older Black voters, younger Black voters.
I think in particular now we are seeing from voters who are watching what's going on in our country and realizing that we need a leader who cares about people, who is honest, who's empathetic, who believes in the soul of our country. And I think they see that in Joe Biden. People see an opportunity to get behind someone who really is going to work on making sure that we all can get ahead.
All right, Jason Ray, thank you for speaking to WEWM.
Thanks so much.
Jason Ray is secretary for the Democratic National Committee. He spoke with WEWM's Mayon Silver. You can find all the latest information about the DNC in Milwaukee at WEWM.com. Coming up next, we'll learn about Black leaders organizing for communities, also known as BLOC. Lake Effect Weekend continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect Weekend continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. As we inch closer to the November general election, community organizers are ramping up their outreach to potential voters. But for the Milwaukee-based group Black Leaders Organizing for Community, also known as BLOC, these efforts are happening all year, every year. The organization was created to invigorate and inform Black voters in Milwaukee neighborhoods, and not just when there's a presidential election. The woman behind the organization, Angela Lang, was featured in an article in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. And she joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about her work.
So to start here, you know, BLOC is a relatively new organization. What inspired you to create it?
Yeah, it really was, in a sense, a response to the 2016 election. Very shortly after the results came in, we saw that turnout was down. It was down all across the state, but unfortunately, Black voters specifically were to blame for the outcome of the election and for the low voter turnout. And I thought that that was a misguided place to hold blame if anybody were to cast blame. And, you know, I think it's important for us to kind of reshift that and to think about blaming a whole community that wasn't engaged and a community that was essentially disenfranchised. And so what does it look like to not wait for a candidate or a party, but we would engage our community ourselves, and then we would also do it on a year-round basis. So we wouldn't wait for a candidate or an elected official. We would be making sure that we're talking to our community on a year-round basis, and then also making sure that they understand how politics works. What's the difference between a state senator and a U.S. senator? Why should our community care about the state Supreme Court? And so we wanted to make sure that people understood the roles and responsibilities of a political system, so people understood how they can get involved and understand the power and the agency that they have within themselves to participate in a process that, quite frankly, wasn't meant for us to participate in.
You know, you mentioned, of course, so much of what your work is community engagement. So for people who may not know, you know, much about BLOC just in general, can you describe what, you know, the day-to-day looks like in more ordinary times, I might add, when BLOC is doing its work? What does that work look like?
Yeah, so normally we would be in the office, so we're missing that factor right now. But largely, we would be out in the community knocking on doors. In such a big presidential year, we would make sure that we had a bunch of people making sure they were knocking on doors, talking about the election. We currently have 75 ambassadors. They are our field team, so normally they would be out knocking doors, talking about the election, talking about people's issues as well. So normally, we would just make sure that the bulk of our work is done in the field. So our team would come in, they would check in, we would do role play. If there's any big news that came out about the candidates or about the election as a whole, we would talk about it. But before they even knock their first door, we put them through roughly 30 hours of training. So people understood how to have those more meaningful conversations on doors about the political process. And so we take leadership development and training incredibly seriously at our organization. And we kind of see that lens of leadership development as a way to really build long-term engagement and long-term political power here in Milwaukee. In addition, we have a fellowship program. And so our fellowship program, we just started that last week. And essentially what that is, it's a really intentional 10-week training program around basics of civics. So it's a little bit of what the ambassadors get, but a lot more intensive and spread out. But it's also the basics on how to register people to vote, basics in how to write a resume and making sure you know how to use Google Docs and Google Forms. We try to layer in some of those skills as well. So people are also prepared to, you know, engage in the future if they want to be able to continue to be an organizer, or they're saying, hey, I want to maybe be a data manager or a digital organizer or community organizer. Having people develop those skills in addition to learning about civics. There's a lot of training and engagement going on. And then, you know, we also engage with elected officials. The closer it gets to an election, normally elected officials like to stop by, talk about the things that they're doing. And then if they were to go through our endorsement process, one of the requirements is a silent canvas, where they would shadow one of our organizers on the doors, and they're not allowed to talk, and they're not introduced as a candidate or as an elected official. So they're there purely just to listen, not listening to respond, but just to listen to the needs of the community.
What I think is so interesting about BLOC is that there is a big emphasis on that listening part of this equation, which it feels like so frequently it is a bit glossed over in different organizations. And one of the questions that I found particularly interesting, and you must find particularly interesting because you ask it so frequently, is what does it look like for Milwaukee's Black community to thrive? I'm so interested to know, what are some of the answers that you get to that question? Because it's so broad and so specific.
Yeah. You know, when we first started asking it, people were really skeptical. People weren't used to having people knock on their doors, if at all, but knock on their doors and asking them about their own thoughts and opinions. And so that's our way of really trying to understand what are the issues that people care about the most that are specific to that maybe neighborhood or that community. And we've heard everything from speed bumps and potholes to mass incarceration and healthcare and a lot right now around voting rights and voter suppression. So we've heard it all. You know, we hear a lot of things around speed bumps and potholes and stop signs. And we, you know, we tell folks, okay, well, that may not necessarily be a thriving community, but what I'm hearing is that you don't feel like your neighborhood is being invested in the same way that maybe Whitefish Bay or Shorewood is. And so we try to really combine what are some of those really hyper-localized issues with kind of broader themes that we're hearing. And then are there openings and opportunities to advocate for some of the things that we want every year when it comes to the city budget?
Yeah. So, of course, we're talking about more normal times, but we are not living in normal times. What has organizing looked like during this pandemic?
Organizing's definitely been interesting. We've all had to adapt and learn new things on the fly. So good thing that we were nimble enough and, you know, we're kind of structured in a way where we can make tweaks and edits as need be. But essentially on March 16th, we made the decision we were going to shut down our office. So we had about 48 hours to completely uproot our program, get tools and software that we were familiar with as individuals, but as an organization, we had never had. And then at the time, we had to train 50 people on those new pieces of software and programs. So it was a little bit of just a mad dash for about 48 hours and trying to get everybody all online virtually. So we're doing a lot of texting and phone banking. We're not able to be out in the field right now, but we want to make sure that we're still engaging people, specifically in these moments of the protests that are happening and the pandemic that's still happening. We want to make sure that we're touching base with people. So we're doing a mix of electoral conversations. We do have an election on August 11th. And, you know, people are really, I think, concerned and are curious about what these elections look like, given what happened on April 7th. And so we're doing the best that we can to get out the information, make sure people are requesting their ballot now, sooner rather than later. But we're also doing wellness checks, you know, where we're not talking about candidates and we're not talking about the election. We're saying, hey, my name is so-and-so from BLOC. just checking in, do you need to be connected to resources? If so, which ones? Or, you know, when the protests first started happening, we were asking people, what policy changes do you want to see? If you were mayor for a day, what would you want to see and any policy changes that we could work on? And what's the best way for us to show up for the community? So we get a lot of feedback from the community that really guides our work. And then we want to make sure that we're being a resource to other folks if anybody needs anything as well.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much that is coalescing at the same time. As you mentioned, of course, we talked about the pandemic, but there is a lot of social unrest. There is a lot of uncertainty as a result of the pandemic that isn't perhaps directly related to getting sick, but rather the offshoot of kind of our economy. I don't want to say collapsing, but having a lot of difficulties right now. When you're talking to people about what they need to thrive at this point, what are you hearing from people?
Yeah, I think there's some immediate things that people are looking for. There were times that we were texting around the election and people said, hey, great, thanks for the information. I'm trying to figure out how to pay rent, or I'm trying to figure out how to make my food last. So those were some of the things that we were hearing. I think some folks have settled into a groove, and I think other folks are still looking to continue to get those resources. I think people are questioning, are we going to get another $1,200 check? You know, are people going to be able to deal with the effects of evictions? And I think a lot of folks are really just trying to pay attention to how the federal government is responding in this moment, both in terms of the protests, but in terms of COVID, and how are we keeping people safe? We're getting a lot of questions, as I mentioned, about the election. Are there going to be more than 5 polling places? If I request an absentee ballot, am I going to get it in time? So we're hearing a wide range of things. A lot of it is election focused. But I also think that people are paying attention to things like the Fire and Police Commission a lot more because it's been in the news lately. People are paying attention to our police department. And I think people are doing whatever they can to make their voices heard, too. So we've heard a lot in this moment. And it's something that we're trying to juggle and balance and tackle and figure out all the ways that we can be supportive, too.
When we look back at the April election, which I know you were Block was, you know, lobbying to get it pushed back at least until the end of Safer at Home. Of course, we know that it happened. What have you learned as an organization, but you yourself, since the April election for the November election? As we're looking ahead to the November election, what are some of the things we can take away from what happened in April?
Yeah, I think a lot of us have spent a lot of time reflecting on the April 7th election and then also figuring out what does it mean for November. One of the takeaways, I think, is people were determined and found a way to make their voices heard, although there was a lot of people that were disenfranchised. You look at the numbers, and I think people were really upset that they felt that they were forced to vote in the middle of a pandemic. And for some reason, that was politicized, and it was somehow a partisan issue whether or not people should vote safely. And I think that really upset some folks. I think that really agitated some folks. But I also think subsequently it made people figure out, okay, what are my plans for November? What are my plans for August? My ballot didn't come in time for April. I'm going to request my ballot maybe months in advance. So I think there's that. I think also it's not lost on me that communities of color, which can ultimately sway an election and can definitely sway an election here in Wisconsin, communities of color and those voters are the same ones that are disproportionately impacted by the virus and are also the same ones in the streets marching, saying that our lives matter. And so we're seeing an intersection on all of these things about short-term frustrations, but I also think like long-term frustrations. And so I'm starting to kind of conceptualize this moment in two phases. You know, what is this moment initially between now and November and some of the immediate things that we need and the immediate wins, but also what is the long-term organizing after November? So all of the things that we're encountering, we never have to go through again. And we're making sure that we're advocating long-term for for structures and issues to be worked on that are directly impacting our communities. And so, you know, on one hand, I really see this as a long game. I think there's a really big opening for folks to continue to organize and to get involved. You know, some of the things that are kind of common stance now are paid sick days. When 10 years ago, when we were fighting for it at the city, people thought that paid sick days was crazy. And now it's the common form. Same with, you know, raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Everyone thought that was such a crazy idea. And then we're understanding how we value labor or how we don't, you know, how we value essential workers. All of a sudden, we didn't normally call grocery stockers heroes. We didn't always call teachers and healthcare workers heroes. And so we're really kind of, I think, reassessing as a society how we're valuing the work and the dignity of people. And then what are structures and mechanisms in place for the future, too?
Yeah. As we look toward the 2020 election, there are so many people, nationally, probably internationally, who are saying Wisconsin is the tipping point. Wisconsin is what's going to decide this election. As somebody who works in this, how do you see your work in the context of, you know, this bigger landscape?
Yeah, it's definitely a lot of pressure in this big year, to be honest. I've read so many articles and think pieces about Wisconsin being the state that could flip it. You know, we saw how the election went in 2016, you know, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin were the three states that people didn't expect. And so I think there's a lot of attention played on those three states. And I think people also know that Black voters can also be the swing factor as well. And so Black kind of sits at that intersection. We're in Wisconsin and we target Black voters. And there's really no way to win a statewide election in Wisconsin without Black and Brown voters. And so it makes our work that much more, I think, intense and escalated. And there's a lot of pressure to increase turnout. You know, and we also see that there's some challenges and obstacles in the way. It can't just be a level playing field. We see issues like photo ID. We see how many people were impacted by photo ID. And then that same number of people that were that the current president won the state by. We're seeing all of these different intersections. So it's a lot. I think we definitely know our role in the larger ecosystem. And I think our folks really understand it too, or I try to remind them as much as possible how much power they have, and that a lot of people are really interested in our community and in our votes. And honestly, there's a certain level of power and there's a certain level of influence and I think leverage that can be gained there, understanding just how important the Black vote is. Specifically here in the Midwest.
Yeah. Well, Angela, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing so much of your work.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Angela Lang is the executive director of the Milwaukee-based group Black Leaders Organizing for Communities, also known as BLOC. She was profiled in an article in this month's Milwaukee magazine, and Lang spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. Coming up, Daniel Golden of Boswell Book Company joins us to share his summer reading list with a Wisconsin twist. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. Lake Effect Weekend continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Summertime looks and feels a bit differently for many of us during the coronavirus pandemic. There's no festivals, no big trips, but there's definitely time for reading. As we all spend more time at home, having a good book to help pass the time is a necessity. If you don't know what to pick up next, Daniel Golden of Boswell Book Company has plenty of recommendations. He joins me now to share his annual summer reading list. Daniel Golden, welcome back to Lake Effect.
Oh, it is an honor to virtually be there.
It's great to virtually have you. And although we are, of course, having a little bit of a different summertime this year, you know, I still wanted to keep our tradition of a Boswell summer book list because, you know, we've been emphasizing on keeping things very local in our lives, whether keeping our circles small or travel for the health and safety of others. But fortunately, books can also take us many places while we're spending more time at home. So what theme does this year's summer reading list follow?
Well, I did actually try to go with a local connections list, just because if people are traveling, most people are traveling by car, so they're probably not going to go out of state. And the other reason I like to support our own, and I think it's fun to have the local connections. And, you know, and books are just a great way of, as you said, vacationing without going away. And they're also a natural social distancing mechanism.
So. Exactly, the first. So let's start off right away. Your first book on the list is The King of Confidence by Miles Harvey.
Yes, this is one of my nonfiction picks. I think it might be my nonfiction pick. And it is sort of a narrative nonfiction with a little true crime for people who like Eric Larson or David Gran. And it's super local because it is about a gentleman named James Strang who decided that he was the second coming of Joseph Smith after his passing and set up actually his original headquarters in Burlington. Southwest of Milwaukee. Afterwards, he and his followers took over an island in Lake Michigan, a Beaver Island, which is, it might be on the Michigan side, but it's pretty close to Washington Island, where they basically set up their own, almost like a government, and did a little counterfeiting, a little stealing, what you call consecration, which is where you steal in the name of your religion from non-believers, and tried to make a go of it. At the time, it's the mid-19th century, 1850s, so this book ties into so many of the trends that were going on then. And the religious revivalism, which ties into the story, was actually happening all across the country. And I just thought it was great.
So another book in the ties of historical events, we have Cher Ami and Major Whittlesey by Catherine Rooney. And this one was very intriguing to me.
This is sort of almost history. It's historical fiction. It is based on a true story. Whittlesey was a commander in the Lost Battalion incident of World War I. And he actually grew up in Florence, Wisconsin, which is, I'm going to say it, it's in the middle of nowhere. It's actually pretty close. It's also on the border of Michigan. It's in, I think the closest city I'd heard of was Iron Mountain, Michigan. I think in about 10, his family moved to Massachusetts. So the story is told from the perspective of Whittlesey. The Lost Battalion was when, in World War I in France, this battalion was pretty much surrounded. And as in most war tactics of the day, probably would have been abandoned, except that they got so much media attention from newspapers that the government had to go in and save them. The story is told alternatingly by Cher Ami, which was an actual pigeon in World War I, a carrier pigeon, which was really pre-internet, pre-phone, this is the way that troops communicated with each other. And this is a pigeon that went from the Lost Battalion to the base after losing a leg and an eye. And that pigeon is actually in the Smithsonian Museum. And I'm going to say it, the story is told from the pigeon's perspective, or at least half the story is. It's a great World War I story. She really brings both characters to life. It's actually a story a little bit about queerness, because she posits that Whittlesey was probably a closeted gay man. And weirdly enough, Cher Ami was a female pigeon that was given a male name. And she reads a little into that, but there you go.
Yeah, it intrigues me that the narratives go between a human and a pigeon.
You know, I'm really into the animal perspective. So there was a book earlier this year I really loved called The Story of a Goat, which was a big book in India. That goat went through a lot.
Yeah. We'll save it for another reading list.
I don't know the local connection.
Well, and then also a book that is based on a character story that is popularized is called Bonnie by Christina Schwartz.
This is Christina Schwartz's fifth novel. In this case, it's a historical fiction based on the life of Bonnie Parker, who people know with Clyde Barrow, did a number of robberies around the country. I will say, it doesn't look like they did much in Wisconsin, if they did anything. It doesn't come up in the book. However, Christina Schwartz did a lot in Wisconsin because she grew up in, I'm going to say it, the publisher said, she grew up in rural Wisconsin. So I said, what the heck does rural Wisconsin mean? So of course I needed to know more. So I said, where'd you grow up? And she said, I grew up in Pewaukee, Delafield, and Heartland, depending on whether you're considering mailing address, voting district, or school orientation. So we do a lot of that stuff. Like, why is a little bit of New Berlin in the West Allis School District? I do not know. So in any case, she really brings the character to life. Very different from the film version. She didn't watch the film at all. There's a lot of research on Bonnie and Clyde. She actually left a bunch of papers in a motel. They had her poetry, and she really focuses in on the poetry. This is not a bored housewife the way pictured in the film. She is a woman of thwarted ambition who was successful in school until she was basically cut down by a teacher, but she continued to write poetry her whole life. And what Schwartz does is really make the drudgery, like what this was. It's like we think of like glamorous bank robbing, but no, it was mostly like gas stations and drug stores. And once they hold up a gumball machine to get the pennies. So, I mean, it's also, the relationship is very complicated. And it's really from her perspective. Clyde is really more of an enigma. And really great, lots of research. She went all over the place to do research on the book. Great historical fiction.
And next on our list, we have The Second Home by Christina Clancy.
Well, no history here, though there's a little bit of Milwaukee history. This book is a super Milwaukee book. You wouldn't know it from the cover copy because the publishers don't really care that much about Wisconsin. So for their perspective, it's about three siblings fighting over the family summer house on Cape Cod. But what we don't know is, what we know is that the first house, the parents have died, is also up for grabs. That's in Milwaukee. The truth is nobody wants that one. So it's a fighting sibling story. There's two siblings from birth, and they adopt a third kid, a troubled high school kid, when the parents are teaching at Riverside High School. Because the truth is that one of the characters in this book, Poppy, her like arc is to learn to love her home, which is she goes back to Milwaukee and falls in love with it again. I've gotten a few like ecstatic texts from people because Boswell gets mentioned in the book. So, you know, this is where my heart is. Christina Clancy has been a friend of the store since we opened. She grew up in Whitefish Bay. She did, she was in the UWM Creative Writing Graduate Program where she got her doctorate. She was teaching at Beloit. Oh my gosh, within the first 100 days, she said to me, I'm going to write a book and I'm going to do my launch at Boswell. And I thought, well, good for you, so am I. But she actually did it, except of course Boswell was not open because of COVID. So instead, we did a virtual launch, but she did come in and sign books when people weren't there and posted a lot of photos of that. So, and one day we'll have her reset launch, or maybe for her next book, because she's already written the next book, which is so exciting. It's also set in Wisconsin.
Again, yeah, things to hold off for the future. Do you have any favorites?
Well, let's see. Yes, I have a favorite. And once again, the story is not completely, is not set in Wisconsin, maybe his next one, but the author is a full-time Wisconsinite. It's The Coyotes of Carthage by Stephen Wright. It is sort of an atmospheric political thriller, I guess you'd say, set in South Carolina. This African-American man who's a political operative is basically sent to this very conservative, mostly white town to convince them, to get them to vote on an ordinance that would give up their local historic mountain for mining purposes. If you have good film history knowledge, you might know that's sort of the plot of a book, a story called The Local Hero in the 80s by Bill Forsyth, which I loved. But unlike that one, there's not a lot of heart and warmth. It really, it's just dark and moody and almost like, it's not action-packed. It's almost more like a spy thriller as he puts in the folks on the ground who sometimes do what he wants and sometimes don't do what he wants. And he's a guy on his last chance. You know, he's got a prison sentence. He's got a brother who's dying. He's got a backstory that we don't know about. The writing's so good. Wright teaches at UW Madison's law school, and he also teaches in the creative writing program. And he's got a lot of lawyers that he's trained working in Milwaukee. He's also the co-director of the Wisconsin Innocence Club. So I love the book and I love him.
All right. And then let's go to...
Let's go with Liza Beattie Pritchard. just because I just finished it yesterday.
Okay. It's nice and fresh. The Lies of Edie Pritchard.
I remember Larry Watson is like, it's funny because he only had one book set in Wisconsin, The Orchard. Everything else is in North Dakota, Montana, Western Minnesota. But he's a Wisconsin writer. He's taught at UW Stevens Point and then at Marquette for many years. And he has just retired, but he didn't retire out of state. He retired to Kenosha. This book, like all of his books, of late, the last few books, has this very powerful older hero, in this case, Edie Pritchard. And the story is told in three moments of her life, basically connected to her three marital statuses. It's almost like a literary triptych. And each one has that quiet suspense that Watson is known for. That his book, Let Him Go, is actually going to be a film with Kevin Costner and Diane Lane. It was supposed to come out like right now, but of course it's been delayed in the fall. But he just like, his books have like really great roles for older women and men. In this case, she has three confrontations. The first with two brothers fighting over her. The second with trying to escape her second marriage to visit the first husband, who's dying, and the third one when her granddaughter visits with her boyfriend and his really unpleasant, bad seed brother. So really terrific book. Because it's a triptych, it's got a different pacing from his other novels, which usually just build, but this, think of it as reading three great novels.
So what about Real Life, which is a novel by Brandon Taylor?
Well, this was a book that was not quite on my radar at first. And then the Sherwood Reads people who were looking for authors and books for their next, whenever that's going to be, put something on the notice saying that one of them read Real Life by Brandon Taylor and really liked it. And I thought, okay, I'll try it. So I bought a copy because actually I knew who to give it to afterwards. It's an academic novel about a Black grad student who comes to an unnamed college town. Nothing is ever mentioned in the story to indicate where it is, and yet you know exactly where it is. Like I could walk the walk, Madison, which was so much fun. And he's a Black grad student in a sea of white people. He's gay. He develops a relationship with this closeted other grad student. He has so little support. He gets accused of sexism by another student, which does get a lot of attention, unlike the racism that he is continually faced with in his own practice. And it's really a book for the moment, even though he didn't know he was writing it for the moment, because it looks at like allyship and what a white person can do to support a Black person. You know, because what happens is the guy who's the lover knows what's happening is bad, but only can apologize to him afterwards. It is definitely a coming of age story, a book about a gay person also in a straight world a bit, and beautifully written. Definitely, you can tell he went through the UW-Madison creative writing program where Stephen Wright teaches, as well as Quan Berry, who's another wonderful writer. And there's some similarities to Stephen Wright's book in that it's sort of like, once again, a Black person kind of immersed in a way.
And lastly, we have Weird But Normal by Mia Mercado.
This is one of my nonfiction picks. So this is, if you look at the book, it's like, oh, it has a quote from Samantha Irby, who is a wonderful writer who just had a number one bestseller. And she visited Boswell a couple of times when she lived in Chicago for her previous book. And in this case, it's the perfect match. Mia Mercado is a blogger who actually has amazing Milwaukee roots. She grew up in Glendale and Grafton, which I learned in the book. She mentioned, talks about a little bit about her childhood. And then, I know this is ridiculous, but I went on her. I was like, she went to college in three places. I'm like, and you don't really get a handle on where she went to college. I actually looked at her LinkedIn page. She went to UWM! So here we are in the UWM station and we have to celebrate the graduates. So they're humorous essays and some of them are really silly about inventorying your clothing and how she, as you can see from the book, she's has a particularly hairy body. But also it's about being a biracial Asian woman in a white world. So she is half Filipina And she, as I said, grew up in Grafton. And she talks a lot about the things that people say that are inappropriate to her, often in a very funny way about this. It's something also that we should always have been aware of, but I think we're even more aware of now. I laughed out loud several times. And I would say that in addition to Samantha Irby, I would say Jenny Lawson, especially because Mercado talks about her bout with depression. And for those a little older, Jen Lancaster, who was a big blogger, a number of best-selling titles. So I think any of them would find the book really enjoyable.
And with all these great book recommendations, I'm just curious about how you and Boswell is doing amidst the pandemic. What kind of changes have you had to undergo? And you know, bookstores were struggling and noted to be a struggling industry before this happened. So how have you been able to adjust?
You know, it's every day is a new, you kind of start again. We're very lucky compared to some kinds of independent stores because many independent bookstores have pretty vibrant websites, not due to our own success, but because we work with our trade association, the American Booksellers Association. We canceled months of events, and it took us probably 6 weeks to figure out how to pivot virtual. So now we're doing a lot of virtual events, but they're very different. They all have to be in conversation. I often have to, you know, we can't always find a partner. So I was like, oh, I'm doing another one. We went to curbside pickup, then we went to sidewalk. We've done a lot of shipping, and that's at the whims of UPS and the post office. We thought we might open for browsing, but now the numbers are going a funny way. So honestly, you know, it's really day to day. What I'll exactly do. I do have very beautiful protective plastic installed. There's so many lists of things that you really need to do to be safe for everybody. So, you know, now we're thinking about our air conditioning unit and how many people can we have in the store? So we haven't done really any programs in the store at all, but some of my friends at other bookstores have. We're certainly not the only bookstore that's not doing browsing, but some are doing them. But the way the numbers look, I can't really say what things will look like next week. So for somebody like me who doesn't like change, who doesn't adapt well, this has been like continuous adaptation. And I was like, well, I got no choice. So I want all the people we love to be safe. We want all our book lovers to be safe, but we want to provide books for folks as well. And so after I'm done talking to you, I'll probably be running around dropping books in people's storm doors and going to the post office to mail a whole bunch of things all over the place. So.
Well, Daniel, I want to thank you for your time to put this together and to still share your passion and love of books and reading with our listeners and for us to connect with you in this way.
Oh, it's my favorite program. Honored to be on it.
Daniel Golden is the proprietor of Boswell Book Company on Downer Avenue here in Milwaukee. You can find the full summer reading list and see past ones at WUWM.com. And that wraps up the show for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.